You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, I just got word that they have established what amounts to a quarantine setup here at the local airport and along the border checkpoints for this coronavirus. Apparently, it is much more prevalent than we're being led to understand. And certainly it's come out that the authorities in China have misrepresented the actual number of cases. They're far more than they have mentioned. It's said that this coronavirus is as deadly, if not more so, than the Spanish flu of 1918. In 1918, 3% of the world's population died. Well, we got 6 billion people on this planet right now. If it's as deadly as the Spanish flu, there's going to be a whole lot of new graves. Well, I said last night we're going to continue to talk about missing persons, and I got a request that I discuss ghost, or the supernatural, or the paranormal, ever how you want to phrase it. And I started looking through my files, and it came to light that there's an unusual number of haunted ships that I've never discussed. Now, ships like houses can be haunted. But while it's relatively easy to walk out of a haunted house, it's a whole lot more difficult to get off a haunted ship at sea. And maybe for that reason, supposedly supernatural happenings aboard a ship often appear more threatening than land-based variety. Strangely enough, seaborne ghosts don't appear to have any time period. Vessels of the 20th century appear to have been as susceptible to hauntings as those in the 18th or 19th century. But some of the more, shall we say, memorable stories come from the Victorian era. Perhaps the Victorian cult of the dead and the liking for Gothic romance can be blamed for this. One of the stories that I found fascinating had to do with a ship called the Harwood. The time period was April of 1874, and the Harwood, I've heard it pronounced Harewood, was homeward bound from Pensacola in Florida, arrived at the tail of the bank just downstream from Glasgow in Scotland. Some of the crew appeared to be extremely agitated, and soon the stories are circulating around the bars of the city that there was something supernatural going on with the ship. The local press got wind of it, and a reporter began asking questions of the crew. One man, who had shipped aboard as an able-bodied seaman, agreed to talk. He said after a few days, he noticed the hands were collecting in small groups and talking about strange sounds they had heard from various locations on board the ship. He also said that the name of the ship had been changed. Now, that is considered extremely unlucky. And what is now known as the Harewood originally began its life as Victoria out of London, and that there had been a murder on board prior to the name change. Now, many seamen firmly believed it was bad luck to change the name of a ship, and frankly, such a procedure often did bring bad luck. For instance, when the owners of the German four-masted bark, Rene Rickmeyers, changed her name to Aileen, she was lost in New Caledonia on her very next voyage. It just was considered not wise to tamper with such things, so there'd be a superstitious fear about putting to sea on the Harewood, and that fear be augmented with rumors of the murder. Now, the seaman said, although he worked as hard as ever, he found it hard to sleep, and he often heard the sounds of groaning as if somebody was in deep distress. One morning, he said, he awoke around dawn to see a figure standing by his bunk. It was a young man, about 27 years old, and he could tell at once the figure wasn't human. He also knew it was a foreigner, but he had the equal idea that, frankly, it wasn't going to hurt him. Now, the figure stared at the seaman before it retreated into a corner and pointed to a livid mark around the neck. All the time, the figure's lips were moving as if in prayer, and after that, the seaman frequently saw the figure, who spoke the same words over and over again. "I'm not the man, I'm not the man." It seemed that an elderly banker had been murdered on board the Victoria, and a man named Miller had been hanged for the crime. And the seaman believed this figure, which was seen gliding along the deck on dark nights, but kind of glowing with a phosphorescent light, was the ghost of the executed Miller, who came to protest his innocence. The able-bodied seaman said, "I wouldn't sail on that ship again for worlds." And that seemed to be the general attitude of quite a number of the crew. Now, sometimes the ghost on a vessel is known personally to the crew, and it was common for a ghost to be a seaman who had once served on that vessel, but who had drowned or been killed in some kind of shipboard accident. Now this spectral mariner could lend his weight on a line when needed or give advice during a storm. And it was less common for the ghost to be unfriendly, although sometimes the crew would believe their extra hand might be the devil, or complete with forked tail, cloven hooves, and just the smell of brimstone. John Masefield, the maritime poet, mentioned a ghost on John Elder, a vessel built in Glasgow in 1870 for the Pacific Steam Navigation Company. According to Masefield, who probably heard about the ghost from a crew member, the poop of John Elder was haunted, although the ship seemed to suffer no ill effects from the spirit. Discovery, who sits at Riverside in Dundee, is reputedly haunted. The light bulb above a bunk used by Ernest Shackleton blew up without reason, and it said he stalks the ship that he once loved. But others think the ghost is a seaman named Charles Bonner who fell from aloft in 1901. Well, in the early 20th century, British trawlers, there was the regularly traveled to fish in Icelandic waters. Now, these were steam trawlers with funnels so thin they were known as one-bys after the popular brand of cigarettes. And life on board these vessels just simply was not comfortable, with the men berthed right forward where the pitch and roll of the vessel would most easily be felt, and the skipper and the mate aft, which was considered a more peaceful location to have your bunk. And in every kind of weather, the crew worked on an uncovered deck, gutting the fish, playing out the net, on the teeth of wind that carried ice straight from the Arctic. The firemen had an equally harrowing time, for they worked within a tiny space, shoveling coal into the boiler despite the frantic movement of the boat. And they also had to come up on the deck to dump the ashes, moving from extreme heat to sub-zero coal within the space of a minute or two. On one occasion, a fireman was on deck when a massive wave broke over the vessel and swept him to his death. Yet, witnesses said something of him remained on board. His comrades often saw him working in the bunker, and whenever they came near to his berth, a ghostly voice sounded a warning, "Don't touch my bacca." Although they had known him as a friend, other members of the crew refused to enter the bunker for the remainder of that voyage. And it wasn't just a trawler. Large liners could also be haunted. At the beginning of the 20th century, the most prestigious liner had four funnels, but when Titanic was built, her fourth funnel was false, put on purely for effect. Before her maiden and final voyage, some of the crew saw an engineer inside this funnel where no man ought to be. And some said that seeing such an apparition was definitely a bad omen. Another passenger steamer was blessed with an extra steward who was seen gliding through the dining rooms. Legend speaks of the ghost of the passenger ship Utopia. She was on her outward voyage from Italy, calling at Gibraltar, when she collided with the HMS Anson. And as soon as the Utopia began to go down, vessels and boats from all sizes arrived to help take off the passengers and crew, but
In spite of everybody's Herculean efforts, there were still many on board when she sank beneath the waves. Now, Utopia's owners couldn't afford to lose such a valuable ship, so they had her salvaged, and she was towed to the dockyard at Gibraltar and refitted. Soon as it was practical, she returned to her previous work, carrying passengers on cruises and trips around the world. However, things didn't go all that well. Passengers began to complain about strange sounds on board, and every time Utopia passed Gibraltar Bay, passengers and crew experienced the sinking. They heard the sounds of rushing waters and the cries and screams of people drowning. Not surprisingly, as the story spread, the fewer passengers there were that used the ship. The owners even found it difficult to find crew, so eventually Utopia was sent to the breakers' yard. The ghost had won the day. Sometimes, though, the ghost met its match in a courageous officer of the watch. Norfolk was a black wall-built ship used for long-haul voyages from Britain. On one such voyage, she met dirty weather off Cape Horn and hove to wait until the weather moderated. And while the Cape Horn snorter threw 40-foot graybeards at him and every member of the crew worked flat out to keep the ship afloat, nobody had time to worry about the ghost. However, as soon as the wind eased, some men heard an unusual noise. Not even the experienced boatswain knew what it was, but one man said it sounded like a rattle in a dying man's throat. Well, as superstitious as some seamen could be, the crew was far more unnerved by the unknown sound they'd been by the gale, and they began to see things that weren't there. The atmosphere in the Norfolk changed so that when somebody began to scream during the night watch, men looked at one another in fear. The officer of the watch was a bald young man, brought up in the harsh practicalities of seamanship, and his first exclamation was, "What the hell's that?" And he wasn't disposed to be afraid of man, the devil, or any unidentified noise. Stalking forward, he ran up to the forecastle and stopped at a ghastly apparition that stood in front of him. The figure was pure white, with its arms raised high and a mass of black hair that seemed to flow from its head. And all the time, that figure was shouting. And it was shouting, "The vision of judgment, the vision of judgment." When near this terrible apparition, the lookout cowered in terror in the lee of the weather cat head, covering his face with cupped hands. Well, the officer of the watch ordered him to come out of that, determined that nothing, ghost or human, would get the better of him on his own ship. He reached forward, grabbed the ghost, to find that his fingers gripped only flesh and bone. It was a woman, a real, live woman, one who the third-class passenger, and she'd been driven mad by the strain of the voyage. Possibly the recent storm had unhinged her already weak nerves. He escorted her to the ship's doctor and immediately looked aloft as the mysterious rattle sounded again. Well, the officer of the watch said, "I'll have no ghost on my ship," and ordered an immediate inspection of every inch of the Norfolk. He said, "You'll search till you find it, however long it takes." Well, no doubt the seaman grumbled and swore, for that's the way of the sea, but at last some anonymous man discovered the cause of the death rattle. One of the stays for the galley funnel had worked loose, and the wind was rattling that stay against the funnel. Once that was secured, the Norfolk sailed on, once again a happy ship. The officer of the watch returned to his duty, a man who'd only done his job in the best tradition of the British Merchant Navy. But he had shown that when opposed, quite often, ghost appeared a lot less scary. Sometimes ghosts at sea could be benign or even welcome. One such experience was that of Mr. Wilmot, who was a passenger in transatlantic steamer City of Limerick. He crossed the river pool to New York in 1863. It was a stormy passage, and for a while conditions were decidedly uncomfortable on board. When one gale at last began to ease, Mr. Wilmot clambered into his bunk and dreamed that his wife, who was safe on shore, visited him. She was wearing her nightdress and looked a little uncomfortable to see that her husband shared his cabin with another passenger. But she remained long enough to check that he was all right and had departed. When Wilmot awoke, his companion, Mr. Tate, was shocked that a woman should visit him because he had seen her as well. Well, when Wilmot got to New York, his wife said she had felt very anxious for his safety about a week early and had crossed the sea to visit him in his cabin. She described that cabin exactly and knew that Tate had been watching her the entire time. Well, while British ships were home to Ghost, Baleful or otherwise, Scandinavian vessels that sailed the North Sea and Baltic had their own guest. These vessels often had pixies or brownies appear on board, which could very often be welcome. One of the most fortunate ships in the early part of the 20th century was named Juno. And on board that ship was a brownie. And many crewmen who'd seen the brownie holding the mast firm during the savage North Sea gales, and when the schooner Firmer ran into Juno, Brownie was seen running along the anchor cable to look after both vessels. The Brownie helped Juno to be both a safe and a prosperous ship. One of the most famous voyages of the 19th century is that of the American Joshua Slocum. As far as is known, he was the first man to sail solo around the world in a time before modern yacht technology made such an event commonplace, before satellite navigation system made the sextant redundant, and before radios and air sea rescue units made the sea comparatively safe. On the initial leg of his voyage from North America across the Atlantic, he was taken ill and lay on the cabin floor in great pain. While he lay there, he became aware of a strange man sitting at the wheel of his ship. Afraid of pirates, Slocum approached the man, who doffed his cap and introduced himself as the pilot of the Pinta, one of Columbus's crew. The pilot steered Spray to safety, and Slocum even had the presence of mind to record a song he sang. High are the waves, fierce and gleaming, high as the tempest's roar, high the seabird screaming, high the Azore. Now, Slocum wasn't alone to meet a ghost in the Atlantic, for this is one of the most ghost-ridden oceans in the world, possibly because of the centuries of drama attached to it. As in the case of Slocum, the ghosts or apparitions or whatever they might be can be helpful. According to legend, in 1828, a ship was bound to Newfoundland when the master glanced out of his cabin and saw a stranger lurking in one of the cabins. Suspecting the man was a stowaway, the master lunged in but found the room empty. Although the man had disappeared, there was a message written on the wall: steer to the northwest. And for a while, the captain hesitated, but eventually he decided to alter course, and shortly after that, he saw a sinking ship. The only man on board was the stranger the captain had seen, who said he dreamed he was about to be saved. Now, sometimes there are worse things than ghosts at sea. In 1913, the British ship Johnson was sailing off the Pacific coast of South America when she sighted a ship off Punta Arenas, Chile. As the ships closed, the master of the Johnson realized the ship looked derelict and green moss covered her mast. According to the story, a party boarded the mysterious vessel and found her crew to consist of 20 skeletons. The vessel that they had boarded was the Marlborough out of Glasgow, which had sailed from Littleton in New Zealand in 1890 and vanished. And here it was, still sailing. 23 years later. The tale of the Marlborough drifting unmanned across the Pacific for years was mirrored in the legend of the American vessel Star, although some versions of that story have her name Star of Dundee. Now, seamen, as I said, are notoriously superstitious, so there was some discomfort on board when the schooner Star put to sea with a crew of 13 men. But it was the 20th century, people were more sophisticated, and nobody really believed that sort of nonsense. At least that's what everybody said. At first, the voyage was fine, with the Pacific as smooth as the name suggested, and the crew worked with a will, and the Star performed as beautifully as schooners usually do. However, the Star got near Midway Island, nearly in the center of the Pacific, the weather turned foul. Great rollers rushed on the small vessel, and the captain realized they wouldn't survive. When one particularly vindictive wave broke on board, he gave orders to abandon ship just as the Star ran aground on a coral reef. After a short while in the lifeboats, a passing bark rescued the crew and took them to Seattle, where they reported a loss to their vessel. The Star was written off as another casualty to sea, and the crew signed on to other vessels. Well, 6 months later, the master of the ship, Dune, reported that Star was afloat under full sail and sailing to the windward. The master of the Dune, D-O-O-N, was adamant the vessel was Star. He said he knew her well. After a further 3 months, an oil tanker sighted the Star, seemingly in ship-shape condition and only 400 miles west of San Francisco. That meant that the schooner, with no one on board, had sailed over 2,000 miles from the reef where her crew had abandoned her. Now, there are also rumors that she did have a crew. Some crewmen of the tanker swore they'd seen seamen on board the Star dressed in clothes that had gone out of fashion centuries before. Well, by this time, the legend of Star was well known in the Pacific, so ships were looking out for the mysterious schooner that refused to die. Now altering its course, Star next appeared off Fanning Island, another 3,000 miles across the Pacific, but again, there was mention of men on board. And this time, the reports were more specific. Star's new crew was dressed in the quilted doublets and baggy trousers of Elizabethan seamen. Well, by the time Star reached Hull Island, another 1,000 miles away, the story was better known. The schooner had piled onto a reef that had already claimed a victim. Back in the 16th century, when Spain controlled half the sea lanes of the world, an English vessel had left West County to challenge King Philip. She had a daring master and a bold crew, so rather than cruise the treasure ports of the Spanish main, she had gone south through Drake's Passage into the virtually uncharted Pacific. Here, the Spanish were mostly thinly spread, and pickings could be richer, and they wouldn't expect to be attacked. The British mariner cried havoc to the isolated ships of the Pacific. He ran up the west coast of the Americas, picking up prizes wherever he could, and then headed for the big one. Every year, the Spanish sent two galleons from the Philippines to Mexico. Large ships, well-armed but crammed with treasure. It might be a hard fight, but the pickings would make any English privateer rich for life, just taking that one ship. Steering west, the Englishman headed for treasure and glory, but he didn't know the true nature of the Pacific. A storm blew up, driving the already battered ship in front of it until she piled up on an unknown reef near Midway. There, the master and crew waited for another vessel. For centuries, they waited until the American schooner Star came along and the Elizabethan mariners, long since dead and decayed, took over. Now they were roaming the Pacific, still hunting for prey. Well, the Star continued to cruise, possibly carried by the tides and currents of the Pacific, possibly crewed by Elizabethan phantoms, until 4 years after it had been abandoned by an American crew, she again ran aground on the same reef off Midway Island. This time, though, there was no reprieve for the Star, and the great Pacific waves battered her to pieces. Well, she wasn't the only ghost ship drifting at sea. Wire D. Sargent was a 1,520-ton schooner built in Sedgwick, Maine in 1888. In March of 1891, Captain Dance commanded her on a voyage from La Ghana with a cargo of Mexican mahogany worth about 7,000 pounds. She was caught by a terrible storm off North Carolina on March 31st and lost all three masts, so she rolled back and forth unhampered and free. Fortunately, a Norwegian vessel saw her and rescued her crew, leaving the ship to sink. But that ship had other ideas. Possibly kept afloat by the pressure of her cargo on the hull, the schooner floated here and there across the Atlantic, being sighted and recorded 27 times in the following 2 years. Seen off Bermuda in the summer of 1891, new vessels were launched to try and salvage her for the sake of her cargo, but she disappeared into the vast ocean. She crossed the Gulf Stream at least twice and was sighted on both sides of the ocean in her pilotless surge from new to old world and back. October 12, 1892, the steamer Asiatic Prince saw her 900 miles east of Bermuda. At this point in time, she was virtually waterlogged with her decks awash with water, but so far down by the stern that her bows were clear of the sea with her anchor swinging loose. Well, she continued to drift, derelict and dangerous, for another 4 years before finally grounding a shore at Conception, uninhabited island in the Bahamas in early 1897. And there were other travel derelicts, including the American schooner 21 Friends and W.L. White. The crew abandoned W.L. White during a blizzard off Delaware Breakwater in 1888. She drifted the full width of the Atlantic to come to grief on the Outer Hebrides. 21 friends was seen 21 times in a year and then vanished. Presumably sunk. But there's no telling when ghosts or ghostly vessels can reappear. They're just part of the sea. And then in addition to ghost ships, we also have stowaways. Now, many people think there's something romantic about stowing away on a ship, hiding on a vessel that'll take one to an unknown destination, either for adventure in the hope of starting a new life or to escape from a country or a place that's become intolerable. And there's certain types of ships that do seem to attract stowaways. The whaling ships from Dundee did, for instance, although anybody'd want to stow away on a ship that operated in some of the worst seas in the world and some of the worst conditions, doing a job that was always dangerous and often bloody is anybody's guess. The whaling ship masters weren't unduly harsh with the youngsters they found, but they certainly didn't treat them with kid gloves. The usual response was to land them at the nearest port, wherever that was, so it's quite possible a lad of 10 or 11 will be put ashore in Orkney or Shetland with a ship's biscuit and no way back to Dundee. And there was at least one occasion when a stowaway was simply put in a passing fishing boat and left to the mercies of the fishermen. And the Scottish fishermen were not known for their gentleness. Now, if that sounds a bit harsh, think of what happened to another man who tried to stow away. In the 1880s, a ship called Professor Worman sailed regularly from Hamburg to Great Britain with an occasional trip to West Africa. Well, in November of 1883, she made one of her longer voyages and was at Little Popo in West Africa. The crew were unloading their cargo bale by bale when somebody shouted for the captain. They'd found a body on board. At first, there was a horrible suspicion of murder, but then the captain put all the facts together. They'd found a man lying dead on the deck of the hole with the bales piled around him to make a natural cave or hollow. Had an empty bottle of gin with him and the bone of a leg of lamb, but he was dead. It seemed he had died of thirst. Captain worked out what had happened. The man had waited till the ship had been loaded in Hamburg and then snuck on board. Hid himself in the hole with enough food, he thought, for the short voyage from Hamburg to Britain, hoping to start a new life. But the voyage went as much longer and his food and drink ran out. So he lay there in the dark, not knowing what was happening, without any means of calling for help, and died. There were no identification papers on board the man's body, so his identity was never discovered. Somewhere, someone lost a relative and had absolutely no clue what happened to him. You know, nautical bells were used to basically run the life on board a ship. It's interesting how important bells can be. The sound of church bells can be evocative as they peal out over the surrounding countryside, and some were endowed with their magical qualities and even name. Big Ben springs to mind. The name is that of the bell, not the tower in which it sits. But getting back to my topic, nautical bells were vital. They marked the passages of the hours during the agonizing passages of the doldrums and during tropical storms and Arctic frost. They're also handy as foghorns in vessels that didn't have a foghorn, and when the whale boats were out hunting in the broken ice and floes of the Arctic, the bell was used to let them know the position of the whaling ships. Now, ships' bells are usually made of brass, and their peals are known as bells, as the 24-hour day on board a ship is divided into six watches, which each half-hour marked by the peal of the bell. Eight bells marked the end of each watch, except for the first dog watches, which was marked by four bells. Now, ship's bells have a habit of surviving. When Great Britain was beached on the Falkland Islands, her bell was removed and used outside the cookhouse at Goose Green. Gug in the Scilly Islands had a ship's bell in the church. Legend claims the local wreckers lured a French ship onto the island and looted her when she beached, but the money they raised was used to build a church. Eriskay in Orkney has a church bell that was salvaged from a German warship in Scapa Flow. And sometimes they have a long history. The bell of one of the first screw steamers to cross the Atlantic was salvaged and used in on a store ship during the Crimean War before being hung at the Bethel ship in Alexandria, where it's used to summon the Christian seamen to worship in that essentially Islamic city. From there, it traveled to Rutherstone Parish Church in Aberdeen in 1893, and it may well still be there. Nobody's really sure. And there are a lot of legends about other bells that traveled by sea. There was Great Tom, the Kentsham bell, that was said to be the largest bell that was ever sent to England. And there are a number of bells known as Great Tom in England, Great Tom and Tom Tower, Christ Church in Oxford, and Great Tom of Lincoln, being two of them, but the Kentsham Tom was the bell that caused all the problems. The ship carried Great Tom of Kentsham without any problems, but when the unloading began, things started to go wrong. Great Tom was raised from the ship and was being transferred to land, according to the shipmaster. At the very instant, the rope snapped and the bell splashed into the water and sank. And it was great consternation among the local people, and they asked a local wise man what they ought to do. Well, he gave them the advice they should take 6 yoke of white Michigan that have never borne a yoke. Take fresh withy bands with never been used before, and let no man speak a word, either good or bad, till that bell's at the top of the hill. Well, the locals did exactly as they were ordered to, and they hauled that bell out of the sea and onto dry land. Then they whipped the oxen until they hauled that huge bell inch by inch to the top of the hill where the church stood empty and waiting. Ship's master had stood watching closely, biting his lip with nervousness as the bell had creaked and groaned its way up the hill. Soon as it was safe, he opened his mouth and shouted, "In spite of all the devils in hell, we've got to land old Kentsham's bell." Holy man looked at him in horror, but it was too late. Damage had been done. The band snapped, and the bell rolled away down the hill, scattered all the people who were watching and labored and waited with such hope. They watched as it bounced into the sea and vanished forever. But sometimes, on a dark night or when the tide is right, the sound of its tolling can be heard from deep beneath the waves. And there's a similar tale told of Boscastle in Cornwall, when a bell was shipped for the church, but when the pilot thanked God for the safe passage, the shipmaster laughed at his Christianity and said it was his own skill that got him there. The pilot responded, "May God forgive you." Just as he had spoken, a huge wave rose from the depths of the sea and overwhelmed the ship. The vessel sank, but the tolling of the bell continued, and when a storm is expected, the bells are still heard as a warning to those who mock God. And there's another tolling bell at Bosham, where the Norse stole the bell from a monastery. Their ship sank in the Bosham Channel in the bell hole, and the bell is still heard to this day. Now, Wales also has a tolling bell. And Cardigan Bay was a line of rocks at the Lune Peninsula. They're known as St. Patrick's Causeway, and supposedly led to the Lowland Hundreds, long since flooded by the sea, but whose church bells can still be heard by those with the power to hear. And there are hundreds of other superstitions, of course, such as the belief that bringing bananas on board a fishing boat will destroy any hope of a decent catch. Flowers are equally unwelcome, as were some church ministers, as both had connections with funerals. Sharks following ships were often taken as a portent of a death about to occur on board. And a sure way to ensure there would be a death on board a ship would be carrying an empty coffin. However, with or without a coffin, there were often deaths on ships at sea. In these cases, the sailmaker sewed the corpse into a sail with the last stitch always through the nose. The body was then slid overboard after an appropriate ceremony. On a warship, there'd be a couple of cannonballs at the feet of the dear departed so it would sink. It was a little more damaging for the morale to have the body of a shipmate floating in the ship's wake, gradually being eaten by fish or sharks. Well, nautical traditions have certainly been described as strange, but there's usually a firm basis of sense behind them. Now, there are no specific areas where ghost ships predominate. They can be found in most areas of the world. For instance, there's a spectral ship seen off Abergele in Wales that was rumored to be the Gwynon Gorn of Prince Madoc, and there are phantom ships in the Great Lakes between Canada and the United States, with the Griffin and Ebb and Fitzgerald haunting these difficult waters. It is possible that ghost ships are only optical illusions, mirages created by the same reflection of light rays that causes oases to appear to travelers in the desert, but sometimes the tales can be well documented. And although the tales are certainly improved in the telling, the essential core has an element of truth. For instance, let's look at the story of the Flying Dutchman. Possibly the most famous sighting of this phantom ship was by the HMS Bacchante in the late 19th century. According to the log entry, at 4 a.m. she crossed our bows, a strange red light as of a phantom ship all aglow, in the midst of which light the broken mast, spars, and torn sails of her brig, 200 yards distant, stood out in strong relief as she came up with us. The lookout on our forecastle reported her as close to the port bow, where also the officer of the watch from the bridge clearly saw her, as did the quarterdeck midshipman, who was sent forward at once to the forecastle. On arriving there, no vestige nor any sign whatever of any material ship could be seen. Now, this reported sighting is unique, as it was made by intelligent, sober officers on a vessel, the Royal Navy, in which the future King George V served. However, other men of equally good character and unimpeachable integrity have also reported seeing such a phantom at various times in the past. Most people in the Western world have heard of the Flying Dutchman, that legendary vessel doomed forever to round the Cape of Good Hope. But few will realize that the seas are haunted by a number of other equally mysterious vessels. For instance, there's the Lady Lovabond, an 18th century vessel that was wrecked on the Goodwin Sands off Kent on February 13, 1748. Now, legend tells about a honeymoon going on board the ship with a jealous rival who murdered the groom before running the ship onto the sands. Every 50 years thereafter, on the anniversary of the shipwreck, Lady Lovabond is said to reappear, heading for the sands with her wedding party on board. Well, even without Lady Lovabond, the Goodwin Sands are a dangerous place. Nobody knows for sure how many ships have ended their careers there, but legend speaks of thousands of mariners having perished on these treacherous sandbanks. So it's not surprising they should be haunted. And there are ghosts off Ireland as well, where spectral ships of the Spanish Armada occasionally appear. Other phantom vessels have been seen in British waters. They're said to be a ghostly full-rigged ship that sails the North Channel off the Mull of Galloway. St. Garva sighted this vessel as it sailed across her bows and vanished. Unlike the Flying Dutchman, there doesn't seem to be any aftermath of misfortune, so maybe she's merely a ship running home. Now, while the Flying Dutchman has a whole host of legends attached to her, of the master gambling with the devil, of a crew of skeletons, of blasphemy committed, most other vessels don't have such a history. When British trawlers worked in far northern waters, there were stories of ghostly fishing boats seen trawling in horrendous conditions. At one time, fishing boats able to work just off the coast of Britain returned within a few hours, but overfishing forced them further and further away to seek new grounds. By the early years of the 20th century, British boats fished anywhere from the Grand Banks of Newfoundland to the White Sea. Weather and sea there could be so extreme, it was no surprise that a lot of boats were lost. Fishermen knew the continental ship off northwest Norway as well as the Wall of Death, for the seabed dropped suddenly from a couple of hundred fathoms to a seemingly bottomless pit. Even worse was the passage near the Lofoten Islands. If the boat was vastly unfortunate, she'd meet a westerly Atlantic gale at the same time as an easterly was blowing from West Fjorden. In that case, even a Norwegian pilot recommended that no vessel should enter the passage between Lofoten and Hogholmen. There is one recorded message from British trawler that was the victim of an Icelandic blinder, which ran, "Boat gone, funnel gone, hope gone, goodbye England." It was highly surprising, given these conditions, that overstrained trawler men should see ghostly ships. There are many stories of ghostly travelers and trawlers sailing in horrendous conditions with moonlight reflecting off outer boards and shadowy crews and phosphorescent oilskins. But few of these vessels had names. Nobody could identify them as lost boats. Nevertheless, one ghost ship that was easily identifiable was the Scarborough Smack Northern Star. In February of 1891, Northern Star was in a collision with the liner Bravo a few miles off Hull. Believing her to be badly damaged, the crew took to the lifeboats, leaving the Northern Star to float derelict on the North Sea. Well, the currents took hold of her, and after a few days, she was driven ashore on the rocks at the village of Catterline, about 50 miles south of Aberdeen. After a quick inspection, it became apparent the Northern Star was in reasonable condition and could be salvaged, provided she was taken off the rocks. At that time, every village along the coast had some connection with the fishing industry, so the authorities asked the local fishermen to board the Northern Star and bring her into harbor. They refused. Authorities were stunned. They said, "Why not?" The response was, "That's a phantom ship. We'll not be going on board her." Well, desperate to salvage something, the authorities resorted to the argument they knew best. "We'll pay you 4 shillings an hour if you go on board and rescue the ship's stores." Well, 4 shillings an hour was a phenomenal amount of money, equal to 4 days' pay for a soldier on a very good day at the herring fishery for a fisherman. But still, they refused to go on board that ship. They had it in mind that Northern Star was a ghost ship and nothing would change their mind. Lacking the skill or the courage to board the boat themselves, the forces of authority could only watch as the North Sea gradually destroyed the Northern Star, complete with her cargo. Another North Sea legend is the Phantom of the German submarine U-116. She was sunk the 28th of October, 1918, nearly at the end of the First World War. And nobody was sure why. She was sighted on many occasions later, always when the weather was bad. She ran on the surface with a crew of skeletons on her conning tower and carried a message of future ill tidings. A Second Great War U-boat was known as an unlucky ship even before she began her career of murder under the high sea. The U-65 was built at Bruges in Belgium, and while she was being built, a girder killed one of the dockyard workers. Such an inauspicious start was unfortunate, but her ill luck was compounded on her sea trials when poisonous fumes suffocated 3 men in the engine room. Well, the German High Command didn't release the news, and the U-65 entered the Imperial German Navy, but her bad fortune continued. When her captain ordered a man forward to inspect the hatches, he unaccountably stepped overboard and drowned before he could be rescued. Now, the captain ordered to die, but rather than leveling at 5 fathoms, which would be 30 feet, the U-65 slipped down to the seabed and remained there for 12 hours as the crew began to panic and water and battery fumes seeped in. Then, as enigmatically as she had sunk, she rose to the surface. Inspection later found nothing wrong to U-65, and it was returned to duty. But during routine rearming, a torpedo exploded, killing the second lieutenant and 5 crewmen. Although he was dead, the second lieutenant returned to oversee the U-65 being towed into Drombladok for repairs. Standing with his arms folded on the deck, he was seen by almost the entire crew. Well, the presence of the officer so alarmed another crewman he deserted before the submarine returned to her patrol around the Straits of Dover. The ghostly officer remained, terrorizing the officers and crew even more than the Royal Navy did. Eventually, the U-65 sailed back to her base, but a British aerial attack killed the captain. At last, the Imperial German Navy acknowledged there was a problem, sent a priest to exorcise the boat. But the troubles continued. The exorcism apparently did no good. When the U-65 returned to war, one man committed suicide, another lost his sanity, and the chief engineer broke his leg. And reports of the dead lieutenant continued. On July 10th, 1918, the American submarine 1-2 reported seeing U-65 drifting off Cape Clear with a single officer standing on deck with his arms folded. As the American vessel prepared to attack the U-boat, it blew up. There were no survivors. Naturally, other coasts and other seas have their quota of ghost ships. A Dutch vessel named Palatine was driven onto the coast of Rhode Island in 1752. Almost immediately, local fishermen pushed off from shore to rescue the immigrants struggling through the surf with their terrified human cargoes. Once the passengers were safe, the fishermen returned to strip the ship of anything of value. Laughing, they set fire to the wreck, partly for the fun of it and partly to cover up their crime. Only when they set off, boats loaded with booty on their final voyage home, did they see the woman on board. Fear had driven her below where she'd hidden from the looters, but now she stood on the deck as the flames burst around her. The Palatine burned to the waterline. She was not rescued. But she's often been seen since, burning off the coast of Rhode Island. It's possible that Unlucky's ships were even more frightening. Every seaman knew that ships could be lucky or unlucky. Even before the boat was built, there were decisions to make. In some ports of the Moray Firth, people believed that chestnut or she-oak was a powerful wood that ailed faster at night than during the day, while many boats incorporated ash or rowan wood to protect the boat from witchcraft. The shipwright could tell by the feel of his ass on the timber of the keel if the boat was lucky or unlucky, and once cursed or blessed, a ship was forever stuck with a reputation. Nevertheless, there were said to be certain ways of obtaining a good luck for a boat. Scottish fishermen habitually rowed or sailed their boat sunwise or westerbound as soon as they left the harbor, and this practice still continues in some East Coast fishing stations. There are also lucky and unlucky days. In some fishing villages, such as Crovey, marriages are always held on a Saturday, followed by a week when the groom didn't go to sea. Fishermen expected the weather to change on a Friday, but it was usually considered unlucky to fish on a Sunday, except at Preston Pines in East Lothian, where the day was considered the best for fishing. Obviously, lucky days also extended to boat building. In Scotland, Friday was the best day to lay the keel, and often Thursday was the lucky day for launching, while in Boulogne, it was unlucky to make any major alterations once the work had started. In many places, a minister would bless a boat for luck, but Scottish fishermen believed that a minister was unlucky. In many places around the Mediterranean, ships could not be launched on a Friday. There's one school of thought that believed that this superstition spread from the Muslims who believe Adam was created and expelled from the Garden of Eden on a Friday, which is also the day of resurrection. Both merchant ships and warships could carry luck. The Royal Navy, one of the most professional and successful of all navies, did not deign to use a name thought lucky or discard one that brought misfortune. Perhaps the most commonly told example, and virtually certainly apocryphal, is the story of the ship Friday. According to the story, the Navy was determined to end the superstition that said Friday was unlucky. They commissioned a ship to be named Friday, laid the keel on a Friday, gave command to a Captain Friday, and she sailed on her maiden voyage on a Friday. On that same voyage, she vanished. Other vessels are undoubtedly unlucky. In June of 1893, HMS Camperdown, a 10,600-ton battleship, was engaged in naval maneuvers in the eastern Mediterranean off Tripoli. Possibly owing to a mistake by Vice Admiral Sir George Triton, she sank her ram deep into the HMS Victoria, one of two Victoria-class battleships. 13 minutes after the collision, HMS Victoria crumpled and sank with the loss of 358 members of her crew. Only 357 were rescued. Sir George remained on the bridge and went down with the ship, with the legend declaring that he said it was all my fault. It was now that the legend of unlucky ships merged with that of sea ghosts, for at exactly the same time as the Victoria sank, a few minutes after 3:30 in the afternoon, Lady Triton was giving a party in her house in Eaton Square in London. Many of the guests saw the Admiral walk down the stairs, although his wife had told him he was at sea. Walked out the front door. One of the unluckiest vessels was said to be the Great Eastern, a vessel of over 18,000 tons at a time when a large ship might weigh 5,000 tons. And there were so many problems on her construction that John Scott Russell, one of her builders, was financially ruined, while Isambard Brunel, her designer, experienced a heart attack on her deck and passed away before her launch in 1858. 6 men died during her building, while there were rumors of a riveter and his apprentice disappearing. And even when she was launched, she was so reluctant to move from her berth that special cranes had to be brought in. Now, the maiden voyage of the Great Eastern was equally unsuccessful. There was an explosion on board to kill 5 men. 2 more drowned, and the 3rd was found dead in his bunk. But this time, Milner began in the name of the bloodthirsty giantess. On a return voyage across the Atlantic, Great Eastern ran into a storm, and while in Cork Harbor, an unexplained kick of her helm killed the quartermaster. Later, she ran aground off Long Island. Her luck didn't change, so her career was short. When she was scrapped in 1889, the skeletons of the missing riveter's apprentice were discovered inside her double hull. The scrap metal was sold for 1/13 of original cost. Now, the schooner Finstrom was also unlucky. At her launch at Ireland in 1920, she sped through the narrow inlet where she was built and ran aground on the opposite shore. Ran aground on Gotland on her maiden voyage to England and never sailed again. Fema was another unlucky Ireland schooner. Even before she was rigged in 1874, she drifted loose and rammed another vessel, while her mate, Matthias Matson, saw a coffin in her wake. He immediately signed on to another vessel that was fortunate, for the Fema sank on her first summer voyage into the White Sea. Sometimes seamen turned to women to help cure an unlucky vessel. If Yorkshire fishermen believed their vessel was unlucky, their wives would gather at midnight, kill a pigeon, cut out the heart, and prick it with needles. The women then roasted the heart over the glowing embers of a fire in the hope of luring the evil spirit from the cursed boat. When the women believed the spirit had arrived, they offered it presents to remain away from the boat. Well, to balance the unlucky vessels, some ships had a reputation for good luck. One such was the Bark Law Hill, named after the hill that overlooks Dundee. In the 1920s, the Gustav Eriksson Line owned her, and one example of her luck was when she was in Buenos Aires. Of the 60 vessels in the harbor, only Law Hill succeeded in obtaining a cargo. Now, the lucky vessel was said to be the aircraft carrier Ark Royal. The Germans named her a prime target during the Second World War and periodically reported her as sunk, much to the amusement of her crew. On frequent occasions, Lord Haw-Haw asked where Ark Royal was, to which her crew, crowded around the radio, responded, "Here we are." Eventually, the aircraft carrier was torpedoed, but even then, the Ark Royal looked after her crew. It took her 12 hours to sink, ensuring that they all had plenty of time to escape. Well, there's no secret that British seamen were often hard used when at sea, but until the 19th century, not much attention was paid to them on shore. Basically, he was left to his own devices, often to fall prey to the voracious predators that lurked around the dockside. However expert he was up aloft in the screaming hell of a Cape Horn snorter, however staunch he was when faced with interlocking floes of ice in the Davis Straits, or when an Atlantic storm blew his vessel onto the Hebridean rocks, he was often a babe on shore. The dockside pubs and lodging houses are full of sharks, are ready to prey on naive Jack when ashore. And there were other places throughout the world that were renowned for their treatment of seamen. Straight Street or Strada Strada in Valletta was one, full of bars, bordellos, and dancing halls. Known as the Gut, Straight Street saw gentlemen dueling with swords in the early 19th century and servicemen brawling with fists on any evening. The prostitutes of Straight Street had a reputation for fun and frolics, and one of their tricks as late as the 1950s, and some said later, was to snatch the cap from a sailor's head, throw it up into their brothel, and seduce the man who followed his cap. The Cairo was famous among British seamen in the 20th century, complete with its drag queens and Maltese entertainers. Visiting American sailors frequented the Britannia, an underground restaurant. Ratcliffe Road in London was another street popular with shorebound sailors. The prostitutes of Ratcliffe Road could be extremely friendly or unfriendly if the need arose. It was not unknown for some friendly and honest women to team up with a seaman after a long voyage and acted as wife as long as his wages lasted. It was an arrangement that benefited them both. She'd be scrupulously honest with his money, would act as his wife and housekeeper while he supplied the money. As soon as the money ran out, the seaman would wake up one morning on board a ship and his temporary wife would be out looking for her next husband. There was a street in Dundee named Cottiswind, where the ladies of the night would entice seamen into a darkened room and pick their pockets while they lay drunk on the bed, or have a couple of hefty male friends pummel him into unconsciousness while the lady searched him for anything of value he might have. Now, search treatment was bad enough, but paled into insignificance when compared to the vicious practice of crimping that was commonplace in some parts. It was widespread on the west coast of the United States. Some crimps had colorful names, such as Shanghai Brown, but that name should have been warning enough. The term to Shanghai meant to dupe, drug, or dispose of or disable a seaman and ship him into some hell ship bound for the far corners of the world. In the 19th and early 20th century, crimps usually controlled the recruitment of seamen in many ports, particularly along the west coast of America. Often the shipmaster worked hand-in-hand with the crimp and both benefited. The crimp was also known as a boarding house master or mistress, and they waited for ships to come into port and seamen to fall into their predatory claws. The system was simple, though evil. The shipmaster would haze the men till they deserted without their pay or simply delayed payment till the crew was so frustrated they deserted for another ship. In 1889, 411 British seamen deserted their ships in New York alone, unpaid and alone in an alien port, but the West Coast is far worse, with San Francisco notorious as the worst port on the coast. It might seem strange that seamen be willing to desert at the end of a voyage, knowing that they'd forfeit the wages for a voyage that might have lasted for 8 or 9 months. However, the men had been confined inside a ship for that length of time, with much of their off-duty hours and the cramped claustrophobia of the forecastle. In this tiny space, with less allowance of air than a convicted murderer, the seamen slept, yarned, played cards, and dreamed of a run on shore. Seamen in general, and British seamen in particular, had one well-known vice. They liked to drink. The rescue shipmasters and all the boarding masters knew and exploited this as well. When the ship arrived in port, the captain would allow the boarding masters on board, and they would supply the crew with a great deal of drink and the promise of willing women. After a while, still not paid, the stupefied men would follow the crimps to worship at the joint temple of Bacchus and Aphrodite. And as they left before the official termination of their articles, the contract they had signed, they were not entitled to their wages, which reverted to the owner of the ship. Of course, the shipmaster got his percentage of the money. Well, the seaman would go to the lodging house of the boarding master, be fed drink in the company of women. After a few days, the crimp would kindly find him another ship for a fee. In the most extreme cases, the seaman would be drugged and wake up on a blood boat, a hell boat with a nightmare for a captain and a bully mate who forced discipline with belaying pins and brass knuckles. The seaman found himself, therefore, on a ship outward bound and in debt to the boarding master, so he's working for nothing for some time with a consequent loss of morale and efficiency. And in many cases, shipmasters worked hand-in-hand with boarding masters. The captain paid the crimp a tidy sum for every seaman he could supply, and in return got a crew of half-dope, reluctant, disgruntled men who would be battered into shape by a bully mate. Well, this strange tradition of the sea no longer exists in Western ports in the 21st century, as far as we know. Union regulations and more strict government laws have clamped down on crimping, which may actually be true. Well, we come to the end of tonight's show. I'll be back tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain, when once again we'll be talking about stories of the strange and the unusual. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.